Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. The deadline to run for local offices, from school board to water board to city council, is August 7th. But so far, many of those East County races have nobody running. Others have incumbents running unopposed, while some have competitive contests shaping up. We'll tell you who's running for key offices so far on today's show, and how you can sign up to run if you don't like the choices. The governor has banned schools from reopening in counties on the state watch list, including San Diego. Hear how local school districts are coping in our special report today. Christian Youth Theater, or CYT, has announced an intermission, layoffs, and a leadership change after allegations of sex abuse and racism, and we'll have the tales. Omari Johnson has filed a lawsuit against the city of La Mesa, alleging racial profiling and excessive use of force by a La Mesa police officer in a controversial stop near a trolley station in May. Learn more on today's show. On our arts and music report, hear how local community theaters are coping with the COVID-19 shutdown, including some creative solutions to bring back entertainment despite the pandemic. We'll also have a warning for you from the Drug Enforcement Administration about scammers posing as DEA agents. Then from California News Service, hear why many Californians are facing housing insecurity and could be out on the streets soon if the U.S. Senate in Washington fails to take action soon to protect renters and mortgage holders. On People Power, we'll have a report on efforts by the San Diego Food Bank to feed the many more hungry people across our region due to the pandemic. The county has some new rules for businesses on informing employees about outbreaks in the workplace, as well as new rules on when workers can return after a COVID-19 diagnosis. SDG&E will be holding some drive-through wildfire safety fairs soon, and we'll have details on when and where you can get information, plus free backpacks or buckets filled with everything from a hand crank radio to a solar-powered cell phone charger. A Santee Little League coach with ties to a national championship team has died of COVID-19, and we'll share his story on today's show. We'll have a 2020 talk report from Public News Service, including former President Obama's call for voting reforms to honor the legacy of the late Congressman and civil rights leader John Lewis. Will we play a perennial favorite, Master Gardener Connie Beck, with advice on what to plant in your fall garden? Then we'll have news on how CAL FIRE is preparing for wildfires and what changes you can expect at evacuation centers during the COVID-19 pandemic this wildfire season. The pandemic is also impacting many vulnerable people across our region, including many thousands of immigrants who survived torture and other hardships and are now facing new struggles here in the San Diego region amid the COVID-19 lockdowns. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters.
Candidates are needed to fill dozens of local positions in East County. The deadline to file to run for local offices is August 7th. That includes school boards, water boards, fire boards, community planning groups, city council, and mayoral races. In some races, multiple candidates have pooled papers announcing intent to run, though most have not yet turned in final paperwork to be on the November ballot. But in other races, only incumbents are running unopposed, and in some races, no candidates have filed to run so far. As of our show taping deadline midweek, for example, no one has registered yet in the La Mesa Spring Valley School District. In the controversy-embroiled Cajon Valley School District, where two seats are on the ballot, so far only incumbent Jim Miller has filed to run. In the Helix Water District, three incumbents are so far running unopposed, and these are just a few examples. All community planning groups in East County currently have fewer candidates than seats. If not enough people run, vacancies will be filled through appointment by county supervisors to these positions, where planning group members advise supervisors on key land use projects. there are many other races still lacking a full slate of candidates. Interest appears strongest in city council and mayoral races. Santee Councilman Stephen Houlihan is challenging Mayor John Minto in a race where land use and development issues are expected to dominate their race. Houlihan, a nurse and co-founder of Save Mission Trails, opposes sprawling housing development projects and traffic gridlock, while he supports preservation of open spaces. Mayor Minto is a retired police officer and fiscal conservative who says he wants to attract new businesses, improve infrastructure, and reduce congestion on State Route 52. Police and racial justice concerns are also likely to prompt debate in Santee, where protests and two incidents of people wearing masks with hate symbols drew national media coverage. Santee also has two council seats on the ballot. In District 3, Councilmember Laura Koval is currently running unopposed. In Council District 4, Dustin Trotter, a general contractor who ran successfully for the council in the past, is running against Samantha, or Sam, Hurst, whose website indicates she wants to preserve open space and ensure that development projects are in line with the community's vision. Lemon Grove has at-large elections, not by districts. The financial future of the cash-strapped small city will be a key issue. Mayor Raquel Vasquez, our region's first African-American mayor, faces two challengers, Councilmember Jerry Jones and Kamal Martin. Vasquez originally ran on a platform of reducing crime and improving public safety, encouraging redevelopment while preserving neighborhood character and fostering economic development. Councilmember Jerry Jones says he's running to provide leadership in crisis times. He faults the council majority for approving cuts to public works and law enforcement. He supports a sales tax increase and taxing cannabis dispensaries to raise revenues. Jones also touts his experience as a mechanic, stating, "We fix things." Martin previously ran for the city council in 2018 on a platform of reimagining and revitalizing Lemon Grove. A former land use consultant for the state assembly, who has held other government jobs, he previously called for investments in public health and safety, infrastructure, and critical services, as well as creation of community gardens and farmers markets, plus prioritizing services for seniors and youths. He wants to generate tax revenue through the cannabis industry. Lemon Grove Councilmember David Arambula has filed to run for re-election. So far, Councilmember Yadira Altamirano, who was appointed to fill a vacancy, has not yet filed, but may yet do so before the August 7th deadline. Rambula has sparked controversy over allegations of assaulting a marijuana dispensary owner who has filed a civil lawsuit against the city over the incident. Three challengers have also filed to run for Lemon Grove City Council. Former Councilmember George Gastel, Planning Commissioner Liana LeBaron, and former Chamber of Commerce President Teresa Rosiak, who previously ran unsuccessfully for council and mayor. In La Mesa, so far 9 candidates have pulled papers to run for 2 seats. Top concerns among voters include public safety and police reforms, following protests over police policies and a riot in which buildings burned down and dozens of businesses were looted. Other issues include the future of housing to meet growth needs while protecting character of communities, and how to address needs of businesses and residents impacted by COVID-19. Incumbents Christine Alicio and Colin Parent will face challenges from potentially 7 opponents so far. Alicio holds a law degree and previously ran with backing from the city's police and firefighters unions on a platform of protecting public safety, providing transparency, maintaining fiscal health, and a family-friendly community. Parent, an attorney and executive director at Circulate San Diego, has advocated for affordable housing, walkable communities, transparency, and public safety. The challengers include Jack Hsu, who led efforts to form a Citizens Oversight Public Safety Task Force on police issues. A management consultant, he has also served as president of Cleveland National Forest Foundation, advocating for environmental and economic justice, land use, and transportation issues. Laura Lathayan, a realtor, previously ran unsuccessfully for city council in 2012, and mayor in 2010. Her platform then included eliminating blight, reducing crime, and making it easier for businesses to open in La Mesa. Other challengers include business attorney Paul Mirowski, Alan Durden, Jose Fernandez, and Mark Sulak. El Cajon will hold elections by district with 3 seats on the ballot. Councilmember Bob McClellan is retiring. Also, District 2 is an open seat. So far, 6 candidates have filed to run, including Planning Commissioner Humbert Cabrera, a business owner who previously ran unsuccessfully for the council. Others include Customer Service Representative Leticia Dickison, community activist Stephanie Harper, Army veteran Juan Carlos Mercado, and Martin Van Dinteren. In District 3, El Cajon Councilman Stephen Goebel is thus far running unopposed. In District 4, Councilmember Phil Ortiz, who was appointed to fill a vacancy, has filed to stand for election. So far, 4 challengers have pulled nomination papers. Estela de los Rios, executive director of a fair housing organization, Dunia Shaba, a professor, Billy Thigpen, an auditor with Teach for America, and John Snape, who has not provided an occupation. If you are interested in running for a local office, don't wait until the last minute. Since some races may require signatures to qualify for the ballot or other documentation, fees may also be required to submit a ballot statement for voters to read. The San Diego Registrar of Voters lists candidates who have filed so far to run for many other local races, including dozens of seats in East County for school boards, water boards, fire boards, and community planning groups. You can view that list at sdvote.com, where you can get information on how to run for many local races. For city council and mayoral races, contact the city clerk. The 4 East County cities all have posted candidates' filing lists on their websites. Check the city clerk's page and click on the elections link, where updates are being posted regularly. It is too late to file for some races, since primary elections were already held in March, to determine who will be in the runoff election on November 3rd for Congress, state legislature, and county supervisor seats. But opportunities still abound to run for many other local seats to have your voice heard in decisions that affect your community. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Jonathan Getz.
Governor Gavin Newsom announced a 5-point plan for reopening public and private schools in California, but 30 counties currently on the state's COVID-19 watch list are prohibited from reopening schools this fall, including San Diego County, unless conditions improve dramatically and soon. A 5-point plan issued by the state's Department of Public Health will allow a district to reopen for live classes only after its county has a 2-week decline in COVID-19 cases. So if you want your kids back in school, folks, wear those masks. The news deals a blow to districts such as Cajon Valley Union School District, which just resumed some summer school classes and had announced a blended learning model that gave parents options for in-school, online, or a combination of learning options. Some other districts, however, such as San Diego Unified, had already rolled back reopening plans due to high numbers of COVID-19 outbreaks locally, as has the Los Angeles School District. But the governor warns that districts must fulfill their obligation to teach students despite the challenges of distance learning. He said in a press conference Friday, "Schools must, and I underscore must, provide meaningful instruction during this pandemic, whether they are physically open or not." Now that means daily live teaching and vigorous curriculum requirements, according to the state. Schools that reopen will have to require masks for children in 3rd grade or higher, and also for staff. The state has purchased 18 million child-sized masks, the Sacramento Bee reports. Only children with certain medical exemptions will be exempted from wearing masks, and a child without a medical exemption will be sent home if they refuse to wear one. Everybody entering a school must have a screening for temperature and symptoms. Teachers and staff will be regularly tested for the virus each month. If a teacher or student tests positive, the classroom would be shut down and quarantined for 2 weeks. If 5% of students and or staff become infected, the whole school would be closed. And if there's a widespread outbreak, an entire district potentially could be shut down again. The governor's budget allocates $5.3 billion in education funding to help provide distance learning when needed. That includes buying laptops and academic intervention help for families who lack resources. The action comes after teachers' unions and other educators lobbied the governor to block school reopenings due to the skyrocketing rates of COVID-19 across California. Kevin Gordon, a lobbyist who represents California school districts, praised the governor for putting the health of kids first. But June Duenas, executive director of the nonprofit Support for Families of Children with Disabilities, says keeping schools closed will increase hardship of families with special needs children. Duenas says, "We have single parents living with two kids with disabilities in a small apartment and they can't go out, and obviously it's really, really stressful. A family who has a kid with autism that used to have school all day for their kid and an afternoon program were able to work, and now they're taking care of this kid 24/7. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
For East County Magazine, I'm John Sepulfido. After multiple allegations of sexual abuse of students, racism, and homophobia complaints, CYT San Diego has sent a text message to member families announcing an intermission of programming until further notice, staff layoffs, and an end to CYT leadership positions by members of the Russell family. The National Christian Youth Theater Group is headquartered in El Cajon and has provided youth theater classes, camps, and performances across our region. The temporary closure is not expected to impact programs outside of San Diego County. Artistic Director Robin Rebold-Smith issued the announcement, quote, "with a heavy heart." She indicated that for the indefinite future, no programs will be offered while the group focuses on training and protocols to, quote, "help ensure that we have an environment that promises safety for our CYT students." The messages state that this will be the final week of employment for the majority of staff, including all chapter coordinators, costumes, production, and managing director positions. Moving forward, the Russells will no longer service in leadership roles for CYT San Diego, the message continues. CYT was founded in 1981 by Paul and Cheryl Russell. Their daughter, Janie Russell Cox, has served as president since 2017 and has apparently also departed from her leadership role, though she has stated that all allegations of abuse occurred before she became president. It is unclear whether the Russells have resigned or were asked to step down, or whether any Russell family members may stay on in non-leadership roles. CYT has not responded to our requests for comments or for an interview. Rebold-Smith does offer hopes for the future, saying, quote, "The remaining staff and I wish to reopen in hopes of offering programming to our amazing students again one day," she states in her text message, adding that she welcomes conversations to help build solutions. Attorney Jessica Pride is representing four former CYT students. She claims that CYT founder Paul Russell, quote, "had acute and specific knowledge of the abuse that was happening, asked families to, quote, forgive their predators and allow them to repent, and still allow them to continue to teach children," the San Diego Union-Tribune has reported. Many parents and former students have criticized CYT for hiring Tony Adesina, a choir teacher and former CYT instructor rehired for online instruction during the COVID-19 pandemic, though he wound up not teaching that course. A 2018 Voice of San Diego report revealed that Atenzia, a former Teacher of the Year for Chula Vista High School, was the subject of a 2017 internal report by the Sweetwater Union High School District, which found, quote, "severe and pervasive actions," and concluded that he had sexually harassed and groped at least three female students repeatedly. For his part, the former teacher has denied any wrongdoing and blamed the complaints on, quote, "three troubled female students" in his written response to the district. No criminal charges were filed against him. However, he agreed to leave the district voluntarily. The district agreed not to tell other schools or prospective employers about misconduct findings. The allegations included inappropriate touching and reportedly trying to lure a female student to his hotel room during a trip to Disneyland. Voice of San Diego contacted CYT at the time of its 2018 article, and CYT said it had not been notified by Sweetwater about the misconduct findings. But CYT clearly knew about those findings when it tried to bring Atenzia back for online instruction earlier this spring. Besides sexual misconduct, several former students have accused CYT of allowing bullying, discrimination against LGBTQ youths, and racial bias, according to multiple local media reports. Investigations into sexual misconduct are reportedly being conducted by police in El Cajon and San Diego. Any former students who may have been victims of crimes while at CYT are urged to notify authorities. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Sepulveda.
Amare Johnson has filed a lawsuit against the City of La Mesa and against arresting officer Matt Dages. The controversial arrest of Johnson, who is black, near the Grossmont trolley station on May 27th has sparked protests and accusations of racial profiling. La Mesa police have stated that Johnson was stopped for smoking in public and later arrested for allegedly assaulting a police officer and resisting arrest. After a major protest and civil unrest on May 30th and 31st, police released footage from multiple body cameras, which largely failed to back up the officer's claims. The videos showed Officer Dages, who is white, grab Johnson by the shirt and press him into a seating position, with Johnson's fingertips briefly touching the officer. La Mesa police dropped the charges and opted not to prosecute Johnson for assault or resisting arrest. According to the lawsuit filed in federal court, the officer lacked probable cause for the arrest, and a search of Dages failed to find any illegal substances or smoking materials, police have said. The suit contends that Johnson was targeted due to his race. Specifically, it alleges that when his friends arrived to pick him up, Johnson tried to walk away from the officer but was violently grabbed by the arm and forcefully jerked, then pushed into a seating position. The lawsuit also claims the city had been negligent by creating an atmosphere of lawlessness and discrimination, encouraging excessive force by its officers, and that the department failed to discipline officers or investigate citizen complaints of alleged excessive use of force. The City of La Mesa does not comment on pending litigation. Officer Dages has been placed on administrative leave during an investigation that continues. The trolley stop incident with Johnson occurred just days after nationwide protests had begun over the death of George Floyd, a black man killed by a Minneapolis police officer now charged with murder. In La Mesa, multiple protesters have filed claims over injuries allegedly suffered during the May 30th and 31st protests and ensuing riot. Those include Leslie Furcron, who was struck in the head with a beanbag and seriously injured. Police body cam footage shows Furcron did hurl an object at officers moments before La Mesa Detective Eric Knudsen fired the beanbag round that resulted in her hospitalization. That incident also remains under investigation, but another woman claims she was struck in the breast with a rubber bullet while waiting at a nearby gas station for her daughter to pick her up after she had left the protest. The city previously settled a claim filed by a black teenage girl who was shown on a viral video in early 2018 being knocked to the ground while handcuffed by a La Mesa Police School Resource Officer at Helix High School. An external investigation of that incident found the officer did not violate police procedures. The officer remained on the force, but was transferred out of serving in public schools. La Mesa has had several more protests in recent weeks as pressures mount on the city to do more to assure racial justice in policing. The issue is expected to be a major point of contention in the November elections, with at least one candidate, Jack Hsu, running for city council on a platform that includes strong citizens' oversight of the La Mesa Police Department. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Miriam Raftery.
Welcome to East County Magazine's Arts and Music Spotlight.
Local community theaters have been hard hit by the COVID-19 pandemic. Lamplighters Community Theater in La Mesa has been producing for 82 seasons, but none presented the artistic and financial challenges of this one. Paul Erickson, president of Lamplighters Board of Directors, says it's very difficult to plan anything. But Lamplighters has made plans, even as the COVID-19 pandemic surges in California. The theater, which was forced to close its doors, like community and professional theaters around San Diego County and across much of the nation, has picked a season that includes a production of Ron Hutchinson's Moonlight and Magnolias and A.R. Gurney's The Cocktail Hour. Erickson says the theater is ready to implement a new plan to keep patrons safe with social distancing following county guidelines. But it may be well into next year before the curtain can rise, after the state and local governments determine it's safe to stage live shows indoors. Even after reopening occurs, Erickson says with social distancing of 6 feet between everyone, Lamplighters could only accommodate 25% of a full house. That will make it tough to survive economically. Erickson says Lamplighters is dependent on the generosity of a theater company's landlord for now, and they don't know how much longer he'll be willing to forgo rental payments. Santee's Off-Broadway Live has a different kind of plan. It's received permission from the city of Santee to construct an outdoor musical theater performance area and seating in its parking lot. Co-founder Steve Rolfe says Off-Broadway Live will be able to seat about 56 people outdoors, far less than the 90 seats it had indoors. The good news is that most of the shows are already sold out, including most performances of Jukebox and several musical performances of songs by popular groups such as the Beach Boys, ABBA, Frankie Valli, and a Best of All Encores performance. Community Actors Theater, or CAT, in San Diego is relying on the generosity of its donors. Executive Director Jenny Hamilton says the theater is not in danger of losing its space on 54th Street for now, but acknowledges it's a big struggle. The group is planning a future production of Oscar Wilde's classic comedy of manners, The Importance of Being Earnest. The cast has been rehearsing lines on Zoom and will do blocking, the physical staging of actors, whenever the theater can reopen. Moxie Theater, a professional company with employees, was able to qualify for the Paycheck Protection Program, including loan forgiveness from the Small Business Administration. Moxie has been producing original Zoom theater mini-productions, and it's streaming them free while asking viewers for donations. Executive Artistic Director Jennifer Eve Thorne says she's grateful to be able to make work that audiences want to watch, even though everything is different. Thorne called Moxie's biggest challenge trying to move ahead with that show-must-go-on attitude when we can't control whether we can be there in person. Thanks to support of longtime donors and a trickle of income from Zoom productions, Moxie is okay for now financially, she says. But when the theater reopens, production costs will be higher than ever before due to the need to restructure the space, which will mean added struggles for the company that highlights works by women playwrights. The even larger San Diego Repertory Theater has also created virtual programming during the COVID-19 shutdown. Artistic Director Sam Woodhouse says, if we were going to maintain an artistic presence in the community beyond rebroadcasting shows from the past, we had to be making new art, and the medium was going to be electronic. The Rep's programming since March has included Instagram Live interviews with artists, familiar actors recording their favorite monologues or speeches, and even a virtual resurrection of the 2018 audience interactive production Beach Town, titled Beach Town Live. Coming up in September is a streaming version of the theater's annual Latinx New Play Festival. Usually, the Rep spends a year working on just one production, but now, Woodhouse says, we're doing it in a matter of weeks. The Rep got a forgivable loan through the CARES program and has strong support of donors, many of whom sent double or triple their usual gift, says Woodhouse. Although the theater is now dependent on the generosity of donors and subscribers without the ability to sell tickets, Woodhouse vows, we're not about to close our doors because I can't open them. Recording for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery. Now it's time for East County Magazine's Scammers, Schemers, and Swindlers Report, shining a light on shady deals all around us.
The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration is warning the public and medical practitioners about phone calls by scammers posing as DEA employees who try to defraud and extort victims. The schemers call the victims, spoofing DEA's phone numbers in order to appear legitimate. Then they threaten arrest, prosecution, and imprisonment for supposed violations of federal drug laws or involvement in drug trafficking activities, unless victims pay a fine. Callers use fake names and badge numbers of DEA officials and may refuse to speak to anyone other than their targeted victim, threaten arrest, or in the case of medical practitioners, revocation of their DEA numbers, demand thousands of dollars via wire transfer or untraceable gift cards taken over the phone, and ask for personal information, such as a Social Security number. DEA personnel never contact members of the public or practitioners by telephone to demand payment. They will not request personal information over the phone and only notify people of a legitimate investigation or legal action via a letter or in person. Impersonating a federal agent is a violation of federal law. If you receive a call from someone claiming to be with the DEA, You should report that contact by calling 877-792-283. That's 877-702-283. Or file a scam report online at DEA.gov. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
California families of color are bearing the brunt of the pandemic while also working many of the jobs essential to the economy. So advocates are urging the U.S. Senate to make sure their basic needs are met. The House passed the $3 trillion Heroes Act in May, but the Senate has yet to act. Gabriela Barbosa with the Children's Partnership says without help, many families face irreparable harm to their health and well-being.
So we really want Congress to include supports around food, housing, access to health care, and income support in the next iteration of federal legislation around the pandemic.
Advocates want legislators to approve $1,200 a month in cash relief to families, including immigrants and mixed-status families. They're also calling for $100 billion in emergency rental assistance and a 14% rise in the amount feds pay states in Medicaid matching funds. Deborah Weinstein is the executive director of the nonprofit Coalition on Human Needs. She says Congress needs to take bold action before federal unemployment benefits and the eviction moratorium run out.
We have not experienced anything like this for 100 years. We've got a stubborn disease that is keeping our economy from functioning the way it should. We cannot let our families suffer in this way. The consequences to children are so grave.
Weinstein is also calling for $1 trillion in aid to state and local governments in order to stave off huge cuts in Medi-Cal, education, and social services. Senate Republicans are in favor of a relief bill that would provide direct stimulus payments to Americans and relief for businesses. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
The East County Magazine Show on KNSJ Radio is produced by the nonprofit Heartland Coalition. We're your community news. We reflect your interest, not special interest. You can get involved by volunteering, get trained to be a citizen journalist, and support East County Magazine at www.eastcountymagazine.org. And you can send your news tips and story ideas to editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Now stay tuned for part two of the East County Magazine radio show.
This is East County Magazine's People Power, profiling local people making a positive difference in our community and our world.
This is John Sepulveda with the People Power Report. Amid the COVID-19 pandemic, the number of people who are hungry and in need of food across our region has skyrocketed. And it's not just the homeless anymore who are seeking out assistance to meet their daily food needs, since many people have lost their jobs or been forced to close down businesses. According to Jim Flores, president and CEO of the Jacobs and Cushman San Diego Food Bank, during the first half of this year, the food bank distributed over 42 million pounds of food. That's 43% more than in the previous years. 22% of that food was distributed in East County, or about 9.5 million pounds distributed around 100 nonprofit partners in this region. Since the food bank, a nonprofit, buys food in bulk, every dollar donated can help a family create up to 5 meals. You can donate or volunteer to help at sandiegofoodbank.org. The food bank, which has 75 employees, also has some paid positions available. The food bank's goal is to end hunger in our local communities. During the COVID-19 pandemic, Floros says he's been working 14 or 15 hours a day towards that goal. He's been the president and CEO of our local food bank since 2013 and is also chairman of the California Association of Food Banks, which represents 41 food banks statewide. His mantra is, "Do the right thing." Floros emphasizes there is no shame in seeking help. During the pandemic, food insecurity has hit middle as well as low-income families. A person can own a nice home, yet still not have enough to eat due to layoffs or work furloughs during the pandemic. The food bank receives some funding from the U.S. Department of Agriculture and other funds from individual donors, partnering with organizations such as 211 San Diego, which you can call to find a food distribution site in your neighborhood. The food bank has faced challenges due to COVID-19, including interruptions in the supply chain. At times, it has ordered large amounts of food that didn't get delivered on time, so the organization has increased its stockpiles. Before the pandemic, the food bank was serving around 350,000 people a month. Now it's more than 600,000 a month. At one point, 15% of everyone in San Diego was unemployed due to the pandemic. And it may get worse. According to Floros, 50% of small businesses are expected to fail. To handle the increased demand and keep people safe with social distancing, the food bank has shifted to drive-through food distributions. The first ones proved so popular that thousands of people had to be turned away in Mission Valley, Grossmont, and Southwest Community Colleges, and even in Del Mar, a normally affluent community. Many stayed even after the food ran out, desperately hoping for help. Since then, the food bank has created super food pantries that include service to rural East County's backcountry region through three mobile pantries with drive-through and walk-up food distribution services, since not everybody has a vehicle. The food bank is also offering diaper distribution each month for low-income families through a state-funded program, since child care centers require diapers to care for children of working parents. The nonprofit hopes to continue the program with donations from the public. It takes money to end hunger in our communities. Government programs are often not enough, so the food bank relies on its network of nonprofit organizations, donations, and volunteers on a perpetual basis, although during the pandemic, demand for all of these things is higher than ever before. You can help by volunteering, donating, or hosting a virtual food drive by signing up at sandiegofoodbank.org. And if you're hungry, or you know someone who is, you can find a list of food distribution sites in your community at sandiegofoodbank.org/get help. I'm John Sepulvedo for East County Magazine on KNSJ.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the network for social justice.
Employers across San Diego County must now disclose to all employees if an outbreak of COVID-19 occurs at the workplace. An outbreak is defined as three or more cases in 14 days. In addition, businesses are now strongly urged, though not required, to provide notification if even a single employee is diagnosed with COVID-19 in the workplace, under the new order issued by Dr. Wilma Wooten, the county's public health official. Supervisor Nathan Fletcher announced Wednesday that while most businesses have acted responsibly, due to the growing number of outbreaks, the county wants to be sure that employers are notifying employees of possible exposure and that workers are given information on steps they should take. While most community outbreaks have occurred in bars or restaurants, a significant number have also occurred in other businesses, ranging from offices and manufacturing facilities to a salon, barbershop, and a gym that was operating illegally. On July 27th, the county also issued new guidelines for when employees can return to work, based on new guidance from the Centers for Disease Control. Employers no longer have to require that employees who tested positive for COVID-19 get tested again before they come back to work and end home isolation, provided at least 10 days have passed since mild to moderate symptoms started, the person has not had a fever for 24 hours without taking medications to lower that fever, and symptoms have resolved. People who tested positive for COVID-19 but never developed symptoms can stop isolation 10 days after their first positive diagnostic test. People with severe or critical illness and those who are severely immunocompromised should wait 20 days after symptoms develop and one day after fever ends before they return to work and end isolation. People who are severely immunocompromised but don't have any symptoms can leave isolation 20 days after testing positive. Over 550 deaths and more than 28,000 cases have been confirmed in San Diego County since February 14th through late July. The county remains above three of the state's trigger levels, mandating a rollback of some business openings and delays in schools reopening. Those triggers include positive test rates, hospitalizations, and community outbreaks. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
With fire season around the corner, SDG&E has announced a series of drive-through wildfire safety fairs. You can get a free emergency preparedness backpack and or bucket, plus learn how to protect your family and property at upcoming drive-through wildfire safety fairs hosted by San Diego Gas and Electric. The backpack includes a solar hand crank radio, solar cell phone charger, a power inverter for plugging items into your car to charge, a flashlight, water bag, first aid kit, toilet paper, face mask, and more. You'll receive information about stocking an emergency kit, developing an emergency plan, and designing or modifying the space around your home to resist wildfire. You can also learn about SDG&E's Generator Grant Program, public safety power shutoffs, energy-efficient programs, a medical baseline program, and vegetation management. Plus, you can speak with the utility company's meteorology, fire science, and climate adaptation team. Preparedness backpacks and/or buckets with supplies will be provided on a first-come, first-served basis, while supplies last on a one-per-vehicle basis. The drive-through wildfire safety fairs also include music, fresh kettle corn, and drinks that you can enjoy in the comfort of your car. Due to COVID-19, please wear protective face coverings or masks. The next SG&E drive-through safety fairs will be held at the following locations: Bates Nut Farm in Valley Center on August 22nd, Mountain Empire High School in Pine Valley on September 12th, and Viejas Casino's East parking lot on September 26th. All of these events are on Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 12 p.m. RSVPs are recommended. To RSVP or get more information, visit sdge.com and click on the Wildfire Safety Fairs image at the bottom of the page. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
Hamul resident Gregory Denny, who worked at Taylor Guitars and was a former Little League coach, has died of COVID-19. His wife, Kim Denny, announced his passing on Facebook, calling him her guardian angel. Greg Denny grew up in San Diego, studied at the American Military University, and worked for a real estate company before joining Taylor Guitars. A father and grandfather, he was an active volunteer in local youth baseball. He served as a manager and coach at Spring Valley Little League for many years and traveled with Lemon Grove Little League's senior team in 2012, Redo, when the team won the Western Region Championship and went on to become U.S. national champions. His sister-in-law has started a GoFundMe account to assist the family of Greg Denny, who was in a hospital ICU unit on a ventilator since mid-June until his death in late July. Services are pending due to the pandemic. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
Once we pass the John Lewis Voting Rights Act, we should keep marching to make it even better by making sure every American is automatically registered to vote, including former inmates who've earned their second chance.
But that's not all former President Barack Obama said at the funeral for the late Georgia representative and civil rights icon John Lewis yesterday in Atlanta, Georgia. Obama called for a variety of reforms, more polling places and early voting, a national holiday on Election Day, equal representation for citizens in Puerto Rico and Washington, D.C., an end to partisan gerrymandering, and even eliminating the filibuster, if that's what it takes. But he also said more citizens need to believe their votes will make a difference.
So we're also going to have to remember what John said. If you don't do everything you can do to change things, then they will remain the same.
Top Republicans yesterday rejected Trump's suggestion that he might delay the election. GOP Senators Mitch McConnell, Lindsey Graham, Ted Cruz, among others, assured reporters the election will go on as planned November 3rd. Ohio's Republican Governor Mike DeWine noted that Trump can't delay the election. It's written in the Constitution that only Congress has that authority.
We hold elections. We accept the results. Even if we don't like the results, whatever it is. And we accept those results. And that's one of the things that makes our country great.
Washington Secretary of State Bob Ferguson says he's ready to sue if necessary. In New York, which had its primary over a month ago, the Board of Elections just finished counting absentee ballots this week. In the 12th district, which covers Manhattan, Queens, and Brooklyn, the rejection rate was 20%. The most common reason was a missing postmark.
That already is such a red flag across the board because, you know, states that you would think of as more voter suppressive, states like Georgia or all of the issues in Wisconsin, all of those states have invalidation rates of less than 1% when it comes to vote by mail.
Cassie Moreno is the communications director for Suraj Patel, who ran in the 12th district House Democratic primary, but lost to incumbent Representative Carolyn Maloney. A federal court heard arguments yesterday in a lawsuit filed by the Patel campaign to get some of those ballots reinstated. Ballots were sent in prepaid postage business envelopes, which aren't usually postmarked. The Postal Service agreed to make an exception for the election, but that appears to have been carried out to varying degrees. While the campaign accepts the loss, Moreno says they want to ensure that all voters are heard now and in November.
People like President Trump and the GOP, the Republicans, have started to point to our race here in New York's 12th district as a reason to distrust mail-in voting. And we want to get out the perspective that that should absolutely not be the case.
And Herman Cain, a co-chair of Black Voices for Trump, died from the new coronavirus yesterday in Atlanta. The 2012 candidate for the Republican nomination and former CEO tested positive 9 days after attending Trump's indoor rally in Tulsa, Oklahoma. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
This is Connie Beck with Ready, Set, Grow. I'm going to help you create healthy and beautiful gardens using less money, less hard work, and much more fun. Hi, this is Connie again, and I'm talking to you about what you should be thinking about planting now. And in another couple of weeks, you better not be thinking about it. You better be doing it. So what do we start with in the fall? You think green. Think of all those greens that you love to eat because this is the time to get them in the ground. Asian greens, mustard greens, spinach, and my favorite, beet greens. Except you get a double payoff with beets. In fact, you get about a 5 or 6 payoff with beets because every little beet seed that you are planting actually is an old dried up flower and it contains 5 or 6 seeds in it. So when those beets come up, you've probably wondered in the past, why, if I only planted 1 beet there, do I have 5 little plants there? What you can do is wait until they get to be about 2 inches tall and then using your very most delicate touch, wet the soil and carefully using your fingers on the leaves, pull out those extras. Leave the biggest one in place, pull the others and immediately replant them 3 or 4 inches away from the mother plant or start another row, but get them a ways away from each other so that they will each have room to grow. As they grow, you can enjoy pulling off an occasional big leaf and stir-frying it or cooking it up, braising it in a pan. They're my favorite greens, like I said. Eventually, much later, you will end up with full-grown beet roots that you can pull out and cook. So now's the time to start your beets. What else can you start now? Broccoli, everything in the cabbage family, kale plants. Pull the old ones from last year that are dried up over the summer. Get some new kale going. You can start cilantro now, and you will have to replant it again in about 2 months because cilantro doesn't last forever. It goes to flower too soon. But at this time of year, with the cooler days and nights, it takes longer for it to bolt into flower. So cilantro is a great thing to grow right now. Right now, I just started my peas. I use Chinese edible pod peas, but any kind of peas can be started now. What you want to do is soak those seeds overnight or even for 48 hours and then plant them. Poke them into wet soil, get them down about 1 inch or so, 1.5 inches, cover them well. And I want to mention when all these seeds that you plant, the smaller the seed, the closer to the surface you plant it. And always press down hard. Annie's Annuals up in Richmond is run by a delightful woman who talks about how she started her first batch of annual plants. She planted them outdoors in flats. The seed flats were right there. She was so upset because her cat ran across the seed flats when she was through planting them. What happened was those were the only seeds that came up. So that was a lesson to her
And it's a lesson to all of us. Press down on the soil after your seeds are in the ground so you have good contact as well as the moisture, so things will start early. You can grow radishes year-round. You can start scallions and green onions right now. Swiss chard, I would suggest that you get that in the ground right away, hopefully by the 1st of October, because Swiss chard likes the warm soil to start. In fact, all of these seeds like the warm soil to start, and then they appreciate the cooler days as they grow and get larger.
Governor Gavin Newsom has announced new efforts to combat wildfires and protect firefighters as well as evacuees from COVID-19 as fire season approaches. The state will hire 858 more firefighters and 6 California Conservation Corps crews through October due to the pandemic. Governor Newsom says, "Even in a challenging budget climate, we have undertaken major action and made significant investments to fortify our state and help fight increasingly severe wildfires." CAL FIRE completed the last of its 35 emergency fuel management projects in May, making 90,000 acres safer to help protect 200 vulnerable communities. The state has also added new Firehawk helicopters and C-130 air tankers to CAL FIRE's air fleet, as well as bolstering firefighting surge capacity. The state has also worked to develop early warning technologies and install fire detection cameras. This year's budget included $85.6 million for permanent firefighting positions and technology to model fire behavior. Ahead of wildfire season, the state won critical safety victories from PG&E to make the utility more accountable. The governor also signed SB 350, which provides major consequences if PG&E doesn't act safely, potentially even including a company takeover. The state also beefed up requirements for utilities to invest in wildfire prevention. All 3 large investor-owned utility companies, including SDG&E, have acted to reduce power shutoffs by hardening infrastructure, vegetation management, improving weather modeling, and sectionalizing the grid, so if shutoffs occur, only small areas would be taken offline. CAL FIRE Chief Tom Porter says wildfire season this year carries an extra layer of danger as the state responds to the spread of fires and the ongoing health pandemic. "It is of the utmost importance that we keep our crews healthy so they can continue their work and that we adjust evacuation and shelter plans to protect communities from the spread of COVID-19. CAL FIRE has adjusted firefighting operations to limit spread of COVID-19 in its crews by holding virtual meetings and keeping non-essential base camp staff off-site. The state has updated protocols for evacuation shelters to require health screenings, dedicated cleaning staff, prepackaged meals, medical and mental health professionals on-site. If evacuations are needed, the state is prepared to secure hotel rooms, college dorms, Airbnb lodging, fairgrounds, and campgrounds to allow people to shelter in non-crowded settings." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Jonathan Getz.
You're listening to East County Magazine, the voice of East County. We reflect your interests, the people's interest, not special interest. As a nonprofit, we rely on community support. You can help us provide community news and reflect a rich diversity of voices by donating or becoming a sustaining member at www.eastcountymagazine.org.
An estimated 35,000 torture survivors reside in San Diego County. Many are facing job loss without access to government help. Mental health issues such as PTSD are triggered by lockdown measures which remind them of house arrest in countries from which they fled. Many don't qualify for CARES Act benefits and are struggling financially. Some have gone without food for days, and for some recent arrivals, their asylum claims are in limbo. Only one torture treatment agency is accredited to serve this vulnerable population in our region, Survivors of Torture International. The nonprofit organization serves people from 90 different nations who fled state-sponsored or politically motivated torture. Last year, over 80% of their clients were asylum seekers. The group helps torture survivors find help for mental health and physical trauma to help them heal, as well as providing evaluations that may support asylum seekers' cases. Unlike refugees who can access public benefits, Often asylum seekers cannot, says Katrina Pimental, community relations manager at Survivors of Torture. And they've been hard hit by the COVID-19 shutdowns. So, Survivors of Torture has taken many services virtual, checking to see if clients' basic needs are being met for food, transportation access, and housing, if they have masks or need translators to understand health orders, or if immigrants have suffered job losses. Some don't own cars, so have been unable to go to drive-through food banks. One person just had surgery when the lockdown began, had no access to transportation or food, and hadn't eaten in 3 days. Many of the people served by Survivors of Torture couldn't qualify for stimulus checks under the CARES Act, so survivors began delivering food, masks, and other cleaning supplies to meet basic needs. Pimental says, with increased isolation comes increased mental health symptoms, like stress and anxiety and depression, and some of the clients even said, it reminds me of house arrest back in my home country. So the organization launched virtual individualized therapy and psychiatry programs in partnership with UCSD and is looking into providing music therapy remotely. The organization is also providing therapy for children and families through schools, including through Cajon Valley School District in East County. Pimental says that refugees and asylum seekers need to form a sense of community here. She says, we're making sure we're providing all of our core services, that no client falls through the gap, and then shifting our thinking and the tools we use to try to get even more creative because we know COVID is a long journey. Despite the isolation and difficulties posed by the pandemic, Pimental observes, our clients are resilient. Many have survived not only torture, but the ordeal of fleeing through many countries on their journey to America to protect themselves and their families. Pimental says, with treatment, with care, with specialized help, they flourish, and adds, our clients have hope. They rebuild their lives. They are and continue to be wonderful neighbors and community members and an essential piece of the fabric of this country. She says her clients understand their social responsibility during COVID-19. They are wearing masks and social distancing to protect others. Pimental wants to see the 35,000 survivors of torture in San Diego County included in discussions of vulnerable populations worthy of support because they have unique needs. Some have come here with their families, but others are alone, and the Survivors of Torture organization is often their only safety net. COVID-19 has increased economic instability and isolation. Pimental wants everyone hearing this report to know that refugees and asylum seekers who survived torture and now call San Diego home are, in her words, deserving of being included and uplifted. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice, this is Jonathan Getz.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Getz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia and the Smashing Beats, Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.
You're listening to KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, the Network for Social Justice.